Hello, everybody. We are back and we have a special guest with us today, no other than Mr. Raul Cabrera. Raul, welcome.
Thank you, Tom. And you make my name sound so cool. I feel like Antonio Banderas or something. Thank you.
No, mate, it's a pleasure. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Good spirits. I just came back from the snow. It was good. And back in old Europe again.
Yeah.
I like it here.
Were you in Andorra? Is that
yeah, right? Yeah, I was in Andorra for 2 months snowboarding, and then I injured my knee a little bit, so as it happens sometimes. But I'm gonna come back stronger.
Excellent.
That's good to hear. You were snowboarding out there, weren't you?
Yeah, snowboarding is like my second to surfing passion. And I just can't get enough of it.
Yeah. I've never tried. I've always wanted to.
Really?
Yeah. I've always wanted to give it a go, but I've just never had the opportunity. I've never been anywhere cold enough.
You should try it, mate. You don't know what you're missing on.
Have you been, Dimitri?
Snowboarding?
Yeah.
No, but I went skiing in Kazakhstan.
But skiing is fun. It's up there.
Yeah. It's the same thing. Yeah, it's good.
But different.
That's nice. So we tried to do this before, but obviously we're all in different countries and it all got a bit difficult with timing and stuff. But let's just, we kind of figured we'd just talk about you and how you came about traveling. Because, you're an interesting guy and you've been to, I think you're the most traveled Ecuadorian, aren't you?
Yeah, by far.
Which is... That's a pretty cool record. You've also, is it the free diving record you've got as well?
Fifth diving record in Ecuador. Fifth free diving.
That's pretty good, man. How deep is that?
That's a little over 42 meters. And I don't do it competitively. I just do it for fun. Jesus. Like a lot of the guys that have that kind of records, they compete a lot.
Yeah.
It's just my hobby.
I mean, so how long does it take to dive 40 meters?
Well, it takes me 2 minutes and 12 seconds. I'm pretty slow because after 15 meters, you start free diving towards the bottom of the ocean. And then you let yourself go. And normally when I reach about 42, 43 meters, I hold still for a few seconds. I enjoy my surroundings. And then I start to come up slowly. Normally people will do it in like a minute and 10 seconds, but I like to take my time just to enjoy everything around me.
Nice. Yeah.
It's an amazing feeling. It's
incredible. Can you explain it for us? Cause I've never done it. I mean, I've dived a little, probably gone 4 or 5 meters max depth, but talk us through it. Like feeling and.
I think I've done a lot of skydiving. I think I have 50 solo skydives.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like after 15 meters or 12 meters, it depends on your weight, it depends on your buoyancy. You don't float anymore. You start going down towards the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah, and negative then, buoyancy.
Yeah, and then you're like negative buoyancy, yeah. And then you start free falling. And you get addicted to this feeling because there is something called a langer, and a langer is like a leg rope. It goes on your hand and it's connected to a rope. So when you are that kind of deep, there is a buoy that it sank to the bottom of the ocean, depending on how deep you want to go. If it's 10 meters, the rope will be 10 meters. And then you connect. It's like a lifeline.
Yeah.
So you connect to it and you get addicted to the sound of it. It makes a special sound like... And then as you hear it, you start free falling. And it's the most amazing feeling in the world. And then you forget that you need oxygen, and then you need to breathe, and then you just keep on going and you close your eyes. And it's like, it's a different kind of meditation. And it sounds cliche, but maybe only a free diver will understand the feeling. And it is that way. You close your eyes or you open them, you relax, and you just let yourself go. And then obviously you have these contractions within your body because it's not normal that you're not breathing oxygen.
Yeah.
And it's also your body go through this metamorphosis that your lungs will compress to the size of a pea, and then you have to, through training, you learn to adapt and you learn to train your lungs so you don't need to come up and get another breath of air. And as you keep on going and you know you reach the optimum depth, you normally have a watch, and the watch has an alarm and it tells you how deep you want to go.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to go, my watch is set to go 40 meters, and I love to go to 50. I kind of try some a few times, but I burst my eardrum while I was trying.
Oh.
And it's just indescribable. And then when you reach the depth, then you have to come up. Then you're like in deep, deep trouble. And then if you relax and you try to come up, you just feel one with the ocean.
Yeah.
It's an amazing feeling. It's just like being inside a barrel when you're surfing. Or it's like scoring a goal if you're a soccer player. It's just the ultimate ride. And it's meditation and movement. That's what freediving for me is.
That's beautiful. You've sold me. I'm gonna give it a go. How about you, Dimitri?
Yeah, I mean, from what I understand, it's quite a euphoric feeling that you get when you sort of start to run out of breath slightly and you feel like you have to come up for air. And I think your body reacts in a way, like everyone says that actually when people drown, their body releases a chemical which gets them high to combat the sense of death. So I can imagine it's kind of, that's why I suppose, Raul, you say it's quite addictive, because you must get a massive endorphin rush.
Exactly. You come up and you have this urge within your body. You want to do it again and you want to try and you want to go deeper. And sometimes you don't even want to go deeper. You just maybe want to go 30 meters and you want to be doing a static under there, when 2 minute static. So wow. You go down, and sometimes I'll use, for the hell of it, stay there for 2 minutes. So the whole dive will be like 3.5 minutes. And normally when I'm in a swimming pool, I can't even do 2 minutes. But when I'm that deep, which is harder, I can force my body to do 3, 3.5, or sometimes almost 4 minutes. And it's just, apparently we came from the ocean when we were, there is this theory that, we were apes, ocean apes, and then we used to go there fishing and...
Yeah, the aquatic ape theory.
Yeah, exactly, that one.
Yeah, no, it's quite, it's an interesting one, because it kind of explains a lot why we're fascinated with water and, you know, why babies, when they're born, they can breathe underwater and all that kind of stuff. It's quite an interesting theory, that.
Yeah.
I've always wanted to ask you this, actually, Raul. What's the one place in your mind that is so special that you would, you know, that you would go back over and over and over again?
I don't know. One of them, it's Ecuador, because I'm never there. Like, I grew up in Ecuador and I hardly ever go there. When I go there, everything is just static, you know. And every time I leave and I come back, I feel like I was on outer space and everybody's got a lot older and I'm still the same. And my friends have kids, my nieces and nephews have grown up. But besides Ecuador, one of the places that I've always got back is, one of them is England. I spent a few seasons in Newquay. Another one is Spain. Another one is Japan, France, and New Zealand. Those are the places that I always feel at home. And sometimes the feeling of being at home is the people that you're surrounded by create that atmosphere, that familiar atmosphere that just make you feel that you're one of them. And so right now I'm in the UK and I spent here so many seasons in Cornwall and I know so many people and I have a few families here, but I think home is where the heart is and a piece of my heart. I have a lot of pieces of my heart that are scattered around the world. So to pinpoint one of them is kind of difficult. So I have like a top few places that I always go and visit again and again and again.
Yeah. It's nice, man. It's nice. It's nice that you've been to all these places. But how did you get into what you do now? I mean, did you stumble across it by accident, or was it always something that you wanted to do, something that you always wanted to do, you know, travel around the world and immerse yourself in culture?
Ever since I was a little kid, everybody, like, in Ecuador, as a developing nation that it is, so a third world country that it is, people want to become doctors, surgeons, because they want to have a better future for them and for their kids. Mm-hmm. But ever I have memory, I've always wanted to travel. We grew up with American television, and you see all these places, and you wonder, you know what? It sucks that I need a visa to go to all these places, and you gotta really make it happen. And every time I will tell my family, my cousins, my brothers, my sisters, you know what? When I grow up, I'm gonna go and see the world. And they'll be like, yeah, whatever, you know. And my mom would be like, son, you do whatever makes you happy, but make sure you have something to back it up. And when you come from Ecuador, all these visa issues are just, it's probably easier to become an astronaut than, for example, to get a visa to go to the States or to get a visa to go to England. And so when I was like 7, my brother went to this Catholic school, and he had this Bible. And inside this Bible, there were all the wonders of the world. I think there were 11, and there were pictures of Petra, the pyramids of Giza, Iguazu Falls, the Victoria Falls, Stonehenge, and Angkor Wat. And I was like, and I used to hide that Bible underneath my bed. And then I look, every time I wake up, I look at all these pictures, and I'm like, one day I'm going to go there. I don't know how, but I'm going to go there. So I had a lot of imagination, and in my mind, my mother built these closets for me and my brothers, and it was like a walk-in closet. And every time I'll go in, I'll dress up in my mind in a way that a Chinese person will look, or a European person will look, and I will just dress up, and I'll go, Mom, I'm gonna go and travel to China. If you wanna come with me, come with me now. And then I close my closet, and in my mind, I'll go to all these places. I'll stop, and I'll be like, Mom, don't come out. I'm gonna speak to these people, and then I'll pretend I was talking Chinese. And then when I was like 14, I started surfing, and then I started watching all these magazines, and I'll be like, you know what? I wanna go traveling, but I also wanna see these places. And then when I was growing up, Ecuador being a surfing destination, we had a lot of foreigners, a lot of surfing travelers. Mm-hmm. And my sister, when I was 13 years old, she gave me this agenda. And then I started writing every single foreigner's address down. And then I'll be like, one day I'm going to come and visit you. And I had it since I was 13 until I was like 17, when I first went on my first big trip, which was around Latin America when I finished high school.
Yep.
And I visit every single person that I had jotted down on my book. And they'll be like, how the hell do you make it here? You didn't have money for a pancake. And I'll be like, dude, I told you I was going to come and see you, and I'm right here. So let's go surf, show me around. And that's how it basically started. And yep. Then I met a British girl. Her name is Kate Cox. And her family was just amazing. And because of her, I came to England for the very first time in 96, I think. And then I never went home. And then I went to all these countries, and I ended up in New Zealand somehow. Because when I was in England, I wanted to get a visa to go to Australia. But of course, being an Ecuadorian, I couldn't get a visa. So when I was surfing Mundaka in Spain, I met this guy. He was a kneeboarder, and he was the general manager of Commonwealth Bank in Australia.
Wow.
And they had another bank in New Zealand. So he wrote me an invitation letter, and then he's like, if you need anything, let me know. And then he sent me his bank statements, and I think he had like somewhere up in the high 6, almost 7 digits in his account, and they gave me a visa right away to go to England, sorry, to go to Australia and to go to New Zealand. And when I went to New Zealand, I fell in love with the place and I never left, and I went to university there, and then eventually I became a Kiwi, and I had so many opportunities. I met so many amazing people, and in my mind, I wanted to travel. And I think when things are clear in your mind, the whole universe is conspires so that you make it happen. For me, it was to travel and see the world. It was a difficult dream for somebody from a third world nation. That's in a nutshell. It's obviously a lot. I've been traveling all my life, but
of course. It's sorry, go on, Dimitri.
Well, I was going to say it's quite an incredible story that actually, you know, if you have a dream that you want to fulfill, it is about visualization. It is about meeting good people and people. You know, good people are always willing to help each other. It's quite an incredible story from that sense, that actually, no matter what goes on in the world, there's always, you know, there are always good people that are willing to help.
Yeah, mate, there is always amazing people. For example, one of them, whether you believe it or not, is Tom. You know, when I first started doing my documentary, I was selling these t-shirts so that I could gather enough money for my next destination. You know, Tom bought a few shirts. Maybe he didn't have enough money, but he was like, you know what, this guy is going some places, I want to help him a little bit. And it's a safe sense of community that you live, and especially if you feel empathy towards other, and you put yourself in their own shoes. And you like, you know what? If we work like a community, everything could happen.
Yeah. I think I bought the t-shirt from you because I believed in what you were doing and I thought it was an amazing thing. And I encouraged others to buy t-shirts from you because I think that was quite a few years ago now, but I think, you know, what you've achieved in that time frame is incredible. You've had an opportunity to live a life that so many people would dream of, but then they would leave that dream and go and live in their own realities where they, you know, they study or they work all their lives. But I can appreciate everything that you've done, and I admire it actually. I respect what you've done, the places that you've been. I mean, you've just come back from Israel as well, haven't you?
Yeah.
I mean, that was, you had some sketchy experiences there, didn't you?
Dude, I had the sketchiest experience, but it was awesome. It's always, you know, when you look back on it, sometimes you're like, you know, I was crazy enough to do this, but you know what? I'm alive. And yeah, man, I you know, when you travel as much as I do, I know it might sound arrogant, but it's just how I live my life. I travel a lot. And you hear about these amazing places that, can you hear me?
Yeah,
that you want to go and see. And there was this place in the back of my mind. A lot of people talks about this lost city in Israel. And ever since I started traveling, I was like, wow, what the hell is up with this lost city? When you think about lost city, you probably think about Angkor Wat or Machu Picchu or Inga Pirka in Ecuador, one of those crazy places. And they were like, no, man, this place is out of The Walking Dead. It's like new constructions, but there's no one living. And there's these sinkholes everywhere. And when you walk, you feel that the roads are shaking and you feel like there's signs and there's this. And there's this ominous feeling about it. And I'll be like, wow, really? And so when I went to Israel, I went there only for 5 days. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up staying for 5 weeks. And I met these guys from Sweden, and they've been walking around Jordan and Israel for 3 months. And one of them showed me his phone. He's like, dude, I went to the Lost City, and that was an incredible experience. So I'm like, dude, we have to come out. We were staying in a hostel. There were 12 people in the room, and it was midnight, and we went outside, and we talked, and he showed me in Google Maps, and he's like, you know what? The bus drivers, they don't want to know about it. Nobody wants to know about it because it's so dangerous. But if you go there, man, it'll be the most amazing experience. So I met a guy from New Zealand and my friend from Ecuador that came to visit me in Israel. So we went there. Obviously, the bus didn't want to stop because you could literally die. The earth falls into pieces. And the reason why it falls is because Jordan and Lebanon have created these dams, so it stops the water flowing into the Dead Sea. So the Dead Sea is receding, and as it recedes, it accelerates this type of erosion, because normally the water levels are really high, but now it dropped like 20 meters in 20 years, so all these big cliffs ain't be supported by the water. So, and that's like a domino effect. And then whole cities are falling into the ocean. So I went to this oasis in the middle of nowhere, and my friend from Ecuador, he kind of fell into one of the sinkholes and hurt his arm really badly.
Yeah.
So he had to go back. So my friend from Israel and I went there. And we got there, it was like 9 p.m. It was pitch black. And then we could see these eyes looking at us from every direction, like cat eyes almost in the dark.
Mm.
And it was full with hyenas and wolves. I didn't know there were hyenas in Israel, but it's a lot.
Yeah.
So scary. We didn't have a tent. Yeah. So we climbed to the roof of this supermarket. We made a bonfire and we slept there. And we could hear these hyenas all night, like barking, and wolves and foxes that apparently they're apex predators, but they've come together to hunt because they need each other to hunt together, otherwise there's no food over there. So that was a crazy experience. And the following day when we woke up, I was flying my drone and I saw these bomber jets, and I was like, man, I probably did something wrong, because these jets are flying over. And dude, that day there were 500 missiles shot in Palestine.
Wow.
So we left the place real quickly because I didn't know. I you know, when you see firefighters flying over your head, that's what your immediate reaction is. And so that was one of a hell of an experience. And the cool part is that I was recording it with my phone and with a drone, so I'm making a short documentary.
Yeah.
A friend of mine is editing it, and it looks pretty cool. You know, you see the desperation, you see the... You see us trying to get there and then making a bonfire, and then you can hear the hyenas, and it's going to be soon on my channel, so on my Instagram, you'll be able to see it.
That would definitely be worth a watch. Where do you think, do you think that was your scariest experience?
No, not at all. Probably my scariest experience was one time when I went to Indonesia and they had election days. And I took a boat from Bali to Sumatra. I didn't know the place. I asked the people, you know, how far would it be Sumatra? And they're like, 5. And I thought they meant 5 hours, but it was 5 days, man.
Wow.
We took a ferry. We got on a horse. We took a rickshaw. We took a boat. We walked. And when we got there, we stay in Nias in Sumatra for like 5 weeks or so, and then we came back. And when we came back, I remember that we got to Jakarta, and there was no one on the streets, nobody. And I was like, that's kind of strange. There's no people here. Why? It was like The Walking Dead again. And there were the election days. And I met these people, and they're like, you guys, where are you guys from? And I was traveling with Remy, with a friend of mine from France. And they're like, you foreigners have no idea. This is not the kind of place that you should be walking about. And that day, they beheaded 500 people, man. In East Timor and in all these places. A few of them were tourists like me walking around.
What the fuck? Why?
Because there was like a civil war between these two political groups. And so that's scary, even though I didn't experience and I didn't see this at first hand. It could have happened to me.
Yeah.
You know.
That's terrifying.
It is, you know. There are some places in the world that you don't want to cross, and that was one of them. But it's like one of those things. One time I got lost in Mexico somewhere with a few of my friends.
Yeah.
We were driving. Somebody make us a road map. I took the wrong turn on, and we ended up in Shantytown. Run by the cartel of Sinaloa, you know. Nothing happened to us. Nothing. They were really nice to us. But then last year, two surfers from Australia, they got burned alive in their van in the same place where I got lost a few years ago. And you know.
Do you think that was a bit maybe racially motivated, as in, you know, they were white?
I honestly, it's just how you portray yourself, you know. If you come across as you're like an intimidation, or you could be like a undercover cop, something could go very wrong. But I'm Latin, and they could see it on my face.
Yeah.
Maybe they were like, you know what, these guys have no clue where they're going, what they're doing. They use dumb surfers. But I don't know, maybe, wrong place, wrong time.
Yeah.
And maybe they weren't having a good day, they got lost, or maybe one of the rumors in Mexico is that they were doing a run and something went really wrong. But right. I don't know, that's just rumors.
Yeah.
I don't know the real truth. But whatever it was, nobody deserves that, to be burned alive.
No, definitely not. I remember reading about it and being shocked, thinking, you know, just barbaric, horrible thing to have happened. But you know, it comes with the territory, I guess, doesn't it? You know, it's a dangerous place to be, really. That they're still developing, aren't they, Mexico?
Yeah, dude. There's places over there where you shouldn't go.
Yeah.
And that nobody goes, not even the locals. And when you go there, things could go very wrong. A friend of mine shot a documentary series over there. And you know, the main journalist, he was Mexican, and he got decapitated. And my friend was like, you know, he was there interviewing all those guys that killed him. And she's like, you know what, at the end of the day, you never really know what's going to happen, because you never know where you stand. You can't read them. You know, one moment everybody's happy, the next one they think you're a traitor, and they'll probably kill you. So it's one of those situations that you don't want to be in.
Definitely. I wouldn't know what to do. I think Dimitri would probably handle himself better than I would. You talk your way out of it, wouldn't you?
Well, I mean, like Raul said, it really depends on who you meet, how you act, how they perceive that you're acting. Is it, you know, I don't know. I think whoever goes there, it is a lottery. Raul, when you were in Israel, and this isn't in any way sort of politically motivated question, but how did you feel any tension between, you know, because they're in a state of constant aggression almost between each other?
Yeah, you always feel that. You know, you try to turn a blind eye, but it's evident, you know, and it right. happens both ways. And right. it's a shame, really, you know, because for whatever the reason might be that you don't know, they just don't like each other, and that's honest and brutal truth.
Yeah.
But I got lost in Palestine, and the Palestinians helped me, and Israeli people were so nice and kind to me. As I said, I was only going to be there for 5 days. I ended up staying for 5 weeks. And people were so nice to me, but I just don't understand. And it's just crazy because that part of the world is so beautiful. And I wish they could just get along. But it's harder than we see, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And in terms of... Do you feel like generationally it will get better, or do you think even the young people?
I want to be optimistic. I want to be optimistic. Nevertheless, I spoke to the young generation, and they don't think the same.
You know? Really?
They feel the same way.
On both sides.
Yeah.
See, that kind of thing is quite scary because it's. It's a scary thing that it's religiously and politically motivated, because that kind of stuff never dies out. You know, it's in their culture almost to hate each other, which is weird because, like you said, I met people from Palestine and Israel on both sides, and individually they're just lovely people, but as soon as you mention anything about their conflict in the Middle East, they sort of it changes them. They immediately jump to, you know, finger pointing, blaming, etc., etc. It's quite sad. Like you said, it's quite sad to see that actually even the newer generations. I was on a train in the UK going from Manchester to London, and I was sat opposite a girl who was Jewish, born in the UK, born and raised in the UK, but she was Jewish. And she said, she was maybe 18, and she said, you know, if the conflict gets too much and they require people to come and fight for them in Israel, I will go to fight for Israel. And I was like, wow, that's quite... You live here... Yes, you share a religion and a culture, but you would give up your life to protect something that is thousands of miles away. That's almost cult-like, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're willing to die for that kind of belief. It's, I don't know.
And you know what's the most amazing part? Yeah, the most amazing part is that there's, well, in the Bible and there all these scripts and prophecies, they always say that Israel will always be victorious. And you know, and you wonder, you know, they're surrounded by all these Arab countries. It's like an ant fighting again these wild dogs, and the ant will win in the end. And it's just crazy and nuts. It's such a small country, and you see the different side of the coin. It's developed, and then everywhere else is not, you know, it's a war zone. And
like it you is, say, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, go on, sorry.
No, and like you saying, she's willing to go to travel these miles, lose her lifestyle, lose everything she has here, to go and fight for even people that she doesn't know sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite... In a way, it shows me how strong of a force religion is, that it permeates into people's lives so much. I mean, it can be used for good and can be used for evil, but it's quite interesting. Now that you're in the UK, I assume you've caught up on things of Brexit nature. What are your thoughts on it?
You know, you could. It's not a taboo, but you know, I'm staying with a friend of mine. He's right wing, but he's like, you know what? The Brexit is the worst part of living in my generation right now. Not long ago, we were part of Europe. Now we're like separating. Things are declining. Now we know that it wasn't the right thing to do, but the people who decided upon, who were brought up in the 50s, haven't caught up with technology, and now we're alienating ourselves, and it's true, you know. I don't know, because I like every country being independent, every country maintaining their identity, and I can see that with globalization and with the European Union, that's a lot of the places are losing that. But on the other hand, right now it's, you know, you were part of this body. Let's say you were the hand, and now you're not part of the body anymore.
Yeah.
And a body needs every single organ, and that's just what's happening. And it's kind of sad. From my perspective, you know, I wish it was the same, but unfortunately, it is what it is, and you will be seeing the consequences within the next few years when it finally happens.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the issue for many people is that the consequences might not be evident in the first 6 months. And people will say, oh, so you see, we told you we're going to be fine. But then we don't know what's going to happen in 5 years or 10 years. And I think this is what people... It was a brave move, I must admit, from people that voted to leave. Because you have the status quo, and for whatever reason, you don't think it's working. So you're willing to take a leap of faith for something better, potentially, without fully knowing the consequences. I think that's quite it's a admirable but dangerous leap to make, I think.
Yeah, but a few people made a decision based on a whole nation which has, I don't know, 70 million people.
Yeah.
You know, and to have that responsibility and also people who are making decisions for you. If you speak to the average Joe, nobody wanted the Brexit, but then you have all these neo-politicians that in their own eyes believe whatever is right, and sometimes it ain't. Sometimes you have to look further than what your own eyes can see. That's why you have these advisors and stuff. You have to listen to them. You can't make executive decisions that could potentially damage a whole nation, and I'm 100% sure that eventually the UK will come out victorious, but right now there's almost a world crisis, and I think if you work together as a bloc, sometimes it's better, you know. But that's just my own perspective and point of view, and
yeah, I respect. Of course.
Do you think your traveling has given you that perspective?
Dude, it sounds cliche, but traveling is the best university. Yeah. Whether you believe it or not, it makes you a better human being, makes you understand different points of view, it makes you stronger, it makes you more humane.
Yeah.
And by all means, you learn a lot, you experience with the real people, with the real locals, and you get to see the world as a real local, not as a tourist.
See,
that's very important.
That's the perspective I would have thought that traveling would give you. And we've talked about it on the show before, Dimitri and myself, and talked about, will we ever be, rather than nations and countries, will we ever consider ourselves one nation? And I think if people had more access to travel, if more people were capable of doing the things that you've done, maybe not necessarily to the lengths that you have, but certainly if they would have had some sort of access to 10% of the countries that you've been to, I think it would make the world a better place in general, because I'm a firm believer of, you know, travel broadens the mind. And I kind of feel if more people could travel around, it would just introduce people to more cultures and make people more tolerant. Do you know what I mean? It would make the world a better place.
I agree with you, because we humans are scared of the unknown.
Yeah.
And you know, all these places, a lot of people are scared of what they don't know. And that's, fear is one of, fear and ignorance are one of our biggest enemies. There are many countries that they don't know Muslims, and not like the old Arash says, not all Muslims are terrorists, and that's true. You know, when you go to Morocco and you travel the lands of that country, you really understand. You see the generosity, and you experience a real. It is a Muslim country, and you can see that they just feel they have dreams like us. Maybe they can accomplish them, but you have empathy for them.
Yeah.
You know, when I see all these crazy things going around the planet, and some of the times I try to understand them, you know, sometimes I don't agree with many things, but at least I have a different perspective.
Yeah.
And I can empathize, or I can sympathize with someone or with a group of people.
Yeah. I mean, Dimitri, you're obviously from, a different country. You're from Kazakhstan. What's the view on traveling and tourism and general world tolerance in Kazakhstan?
Well, it's a very young country. So what you have is, it's a country that's only about 27 years old.
Right.
Maybe slightly older. So people would love to travel, but they can't because they don't have the cash. People that do travel normally come back and they get the bug. What you do notice is that people there have very conservative views. So on issues like homosexuality, interracial marriage, it's not seen as something that is... they still got very, very old-fashioned views of it's wrong in general. For them, traveling doesn't broaden the mind that much, because they come back and they don't... They go on holiday not to experience the culture of the other country, but to be in a warm place that serves different kind of beer, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So they go there as tourists rather than as individuals who want to experience culture, which, you know, suits some people. For people like Raul and ourselves, it probably doesn't. I wouldn't want to go to... my cousin went to Dubai, and he stayed something like 50 miles away from Dubai, as in the center of. So he stayed in an all-inclusive hotel. And granted, that's a lot to do with, you know, the budget that you have, etc., etc. But for them, it wasn't so much about seeing the golden souks or seeing their mosques, which are amazing. It was more about, I went to Dubai. Oh, right, so what did you see? Oh, we stayed in a hotel. It's a 5-star hotel, but you know.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, yeah, but isn't the whole point of traveling to kind of experience different things? And so, oh, well, we went to a McDonald's there, so that's different.
That's not traveling, though, is it? I mean.
Well, exactly.
What does travel mean to you, Raul? What's the whole purpose of it, do you think? What do you think is the one thing you're going to get out of all of these experiences?
Dude, I don't know why, but I think I come from another planet, or I'm on my last reincarnation, and I just want to see every single corner of the world. Yeah. Traveling to me is a statement of my individuality. It's just how I can really express myself. It's hard for me to see myself settle for a long period of time in one time, because I feel that I'm missing out on life. In saying so, one of the best trips, or one of the best adventures that I ever had, was having two kids with a beautiful girl, even though we're not together. I go there to see them a lot, and they live in Denmark. Their names are Milo and Mali, and Milo, it was my favorite chocolate when I was a kid, Milo, and Mali means flower in Thai. And that's a different kind of travel, but it's also a new adventure for me. So I like to see places because I want to see how people live there. I always wonder what people are doing, what are they thinking. And traveling for me is everything. It's the alpha and omega. It's the beginning and the end.
Yeah.
At the beginning of days, when we came from Africa, we were all nomads, and I think that's just imprinted in my DNA, and it probably makes me a little different from a lot of people from where I come from, which a lot of them are like, just like Dimitri was saying, you know, when you see them, they're like, oh, so what do you do there? Oh, I went to Miami, I went to McDonald's, and I stayed in the same place. And it's the same. It's the same. We need more travelers and less tourists.
Yeah.
We need more empathy.
Yes.
Have you had the pleasure of going to Kazakhstan yet?
No, that's one of the places I want to visit.
Dimitri, anywhere you can recommend?
I would say the best thing to do is if you fly to Almaty, and you climb up the mountains, and then you take a car and drive through the deserts. It's quite an interesting country because it's a country of two cities, and everything in between is very much looking 20 years back. It hasn't really moved since the collapse of communism. So what you have is people living in houses which are 50 years old, made of wood. And I don't mean like good quality timber. I mean sort of planks of wood nailed onto a wooden frame.
Wow.
It's definitely... it's interesting because you have this huge, huge divide between the rich and the poor. You know, you'll see a Ferrari or a Bentley on one side of the street, and then you see like a shack collapsing but people living in it on the other. It's a bit like a less extreme version of India, because there's no caste system in Kazakhstan, but it's there might as well be one.
Yeah,
Kazakhstan is one of the places on my list.
Yeah, man. I mean, definitely go in the winter. Very good for skiing. Very good in the summer. Very hot.
Yeah, I think Kazakhstan is one of the places. You know, there are a few places I really want to go. They're probably not on top of everyone's list. But I don't know why I've always wanted to go to Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq.
And, they're beautiful countries. I mean, Afghanistan has a few UNESCO sites, doesn't it? And World Heritage sites.
Yeah.
And obviously Iraq, you know, those sort of places are one of the cradles of civilizations.
And you know what? I met this guy, and the guy that went to the Lost City with me, he just came from there. And he told me, you know, he went to the other side of this valley in Iraq, and there was an Australian surfer girl, and she was getting so many barrels and waves. And I was like, no way. And I'm like, yeah. And then one time I met the Irish surfer, and this girl went surfing in Afghanistan, and he taught the people how to surf there.
Wow.
And it was amazing.
A bit like a new
Iski
sort of
Britton was her name. Iski Britton. She made a documentary.
Okay.
Yeah, she was teaching Muslims how to surf. Muslim girls how to surf.
Cool.
That's cool. Yeah. It's a bit like Endless Summer. Have you seen Endless Summer?
Yeah, I don't remember. Do they surf in Afghanistan?
No, but they basically take surfing to countries that have never seen it before. They go to Africa and they teach the locals how to surf because they have never seen a surfboard before. And they're in one town in Africa, and basically the chief comes along and commandeers a surfboard and demands to be taught how to surf. It's quite a beautiful thing because I think it shows that surfing is a special sport and a special thing to do because it can bring people together. I love surfing, and I don't think there's any feeling like being out in the water with other people who are just as connected to what they're doing. You know, it's an individual sport, but you partake with everyone who's in the sea at that time. It's a beautiful sport.
And you know what it's like? It's, everything is better when it's shared, you know? It's not, you could be surfing in this spot by yourself, but if a couple of your friends or just someone else is out there, it makes it so much better. Just exponentiates the feeling.
Well, you got a witness, haven't you?
Hmm?
There's a witness. There's someone watching. Yeah. And it makes it more special. I agree. I prefer surfing with people than on my own.
Same.
Where do you think's the best place you've surfed? Because I know you've surfed some heavy waves, haven't you?
Yeah, one of the best places, and a lot of people go there to surf anyways, is just Indonesia has some amazing waves. It's just, I don't know, it's something about the place. It's always the perfect storm. Everything is right. The wind is right. The period is right. The waves are perfect. Indonesia, Hawaii, and Ecuador probably. Amazing waves. Ecuador is just home. I learned how to surf there. So even though I surf this place, my mom went there when she was a little girl. She went on a horse.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's called Engabao, which means in Aboriginal language, the king's garden.
Okay.
And there's this perfect right-handed point break, and I used to camp weekends on end with a few of my friends, and actually a few of my friends went but moved there. There was nothing over there. It was just a fisherman village of maybe two people living there. Now there is like 2,000.
Wow.
And maybe one day I'll have my house there, and I got so many of some of the best barrels of my life, even on small days. And it's one of those places that I really like to go back to because there is nothing there. It's just pure beauty and amazing waves. Maybe it doesn't matter whether they're shitty or small. It's just that your friends are there and you have that feeling that you grew up there. And it just makes it more better. It makes it better.
I agree.
What's been the best local food that you've tried? Which country has the best local food?
I just came from eating Indian food. I have these things for Indian food. I don't know what it is, but it's just the spices and everything makes it so much special. Mm. The very, very first time that I tried Indian food besides the UK, because obviously when you looked online, it's like, where's the best place to get Indian food? They would say London, because so many Indian people living here. But I would say Indian food, Japanese food, Thai food, and Peruvian food. Those are probably on top of my list. Something that I was always ask.
Wow, and which country do you think does those foods the best, apart from the native country? So obviously, Indian food in India is going to be amazing. But is there a country which replicates it as well? Obviously you said London, but in terms of,
I think London has a wide variety because it's just so many people from every corner of the world here. Like we went today to this restaurant which was in the middle of nowhere in a small little borough here,
And it was just incredible. The Indian food was off the hook. Just as good as in India. But I think the States or New York and London will definitely replicate or even better sometimes than... There are places in London where you will pay like $300 to go and have sushi, but the sushi, the tuna will be amazing. The chefs are from... Trained chefs from Japan and...
Yeah.
It's a good place here. It's the heart of Europe.
It really is, which is a shame.
Yeah, it is a shame. I was going to say that, you know, but...
Yeah.
It's just every nationality is here.
Yeah.
Every single one of them.
Yeah. Where's your next big trip?
Well, I just came from Andorra. I was there for 2 months, and I really thank my friend Danny, one of the best snowboarders, and his business partner, Gilles, because I was working at the store and helping them, and also as an ambassador for the brand. And then I went to Estonia because my friend is competing for the Olympics, and Van Margera was there, Tony Hawk was there. A BMX and skate event called the Simple Session. And then I went to La Vaca XXL surfing competition in northern Spain. My friend Pablo Suarez, he was in Nómada in the documentary with me.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm in London and I'm going to Denmark. It's Milo's 7th birthday. And I'm going to be there, maybe take him skating for the very first time.
Yep.
Excellent. Big up to
Feliz
Milos.
Feliz cumpleaños.
Yeah, feliz cumpleaños. And telugan, like they say in Danish. All and right. After that, I wish I could tell you where, but it's just one of those things. Maybe I'll be there for a couple months. Maybe I'll go back to Ecuador. Maybe a friend of mine is shooting a documentary in 7 continents, and I might be directing it.
Amazing.
It's about the environment. It's 7 episodes, 7 continents, and there'll be a lot of professional surfers, media, and a few celebrities. You know, Leonardo DiCaprio is up for the environment. And
is this the Netflix show that you're
gonna... One of them. Yeah, I'm gonna be on 2 Netflix. One of them is a documentary about the Tayos caves in Latin America, which was shot in the middle of the Amazon with the ex-minister and with a bunch of scientists, geologists, herpetologists, special forces. We wow. went to these caves that apparently hold the story of humanity. Neil Armstrong went there in 1976 after he went to the moon. He went there. And they don't know why, but apparently he got this chest. No, he got these coffins full of ancient treasures. And he was sponsored by the British Crown. They don't know what he took. And apparently it's here in London somewhere.
Oh.
Apparently this was this metal library that hold the history of humanity after the last flood. So I went there and I discovered a new passage to new caves.
Oh,
apparently
wow.
these caves connect all Latin America, and they call the Tayos caves, and that's where an ancient civilization lived after the last flood. And the amazing thing is that apparently they hide there because the whole world was flooded after the last ice age, after everything melted. So you'll see it on Netflix. Hopefully.
Yeah, definitely. I'll keep an eye out for it. Do you know what it's going to be called at all?
The Tayos Cave.
Oh, okay, fine.
So the Tayos are these blind birds that live down there. Tayos.
Okay.
And cave, as in cave, is
yeah.
called the Tayos Cave.
Well.
And if you Google Neil Armstrong Tayos Cave, you have like thousands of hits, because he was the first man to walk on the moon, and then he was just... a mysterious move for him to go there.
Yeah.
Why? You know, did he see something on the moon? Did he ever go to the moon? But the thing is that he actually went there. And,
well, you've definitely just given us inspiration for our next episode.
Yeah, but you could actually see the promotional, the trailer for my for that documentary.
Yeah.
It's called Tayo's Cave.
We'll definitely look it up. Dimitri, yeah. You'll be watching that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean.
And the one for the environment is just a different one. Richard German is an environmentalist. He's a stand-up surfer from California. And in Laguna Beach is this amazing world reserve. But it wasn't like that. It was horrible for a long time. And they were like, what can we do to change the coast? Why don't we stop human erosion? So they protected this area of around 15 kilometers or 10 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And after 7 years, it just flourished. And now you have all these orcas, dolphins that go to this national sanctuary. They go there to feed. They go there to have their calves. And it's just because it's possible to change the future of our planet.
Yeah.
So this series is one of the aspects. The other aspect is that everything, well, it's a vicious circle because fish have a lot of mercury and plastic, mm-hmm. microplastic, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. everything we eat is just, we're feeding them plastic, so we're eating plastic, and we're like zombies, plastic zombies.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's about that, basically.
Wow. That would be really interesting, because, you know, obviously you're someone who's passionate about conservation. I think, what was your studies were conservation-based, weren't they?
Yeah, I study economics of developing nations and environmental and health issues in New Zealand, in yep. Dunedin, Otago University.
Yeah.
And when I was studying, I wanted to do a master's in environmental sciences, but I took some subjects, but I've shot a few documentaries about it, and I've also done a few talks about it because I'm really interested, you know. I grew up surfing, and when you surf, it makes you, I think by nature, it makes you an environmentalist.
Yeah.
Or pro-environment, for that matter. You know, because you want to be surfing in unpolluted waters. You want to be sharing the ocean.
Yeah.
With dolphins, orcas, and you yeah. don't want to see them perishing.
Absolutely. I think if you're someone who surfs, or if you do an outdoor sort of sport like, you know, snowboarding or something like that, it makes you more environmentally aware, and I think it drives you to want to preserve the environment that you're in, because there's nothing worse, I don't think, than looking at the future and seeing no animals and no plants.
You know what? If we keep going at this rate, it will actually happen.
I know.
Have you seen the film, or have you read the book, The Road?
No.
With Viggo Mortensen? I highly recommend that.
Oh, there. I think, it's like a post-apocalyptic.
Exactly. It's not as crazy. You might believe that there will be like an apocalypse zombie, but it's actually us.
Yeah, and he's having with no his food, son,
trying to
he?
Eat each other, yeah.
Yeah, I have seen it. It's quite harrowing, actually. It's quite scary, because you could see that as a sort of dystopian future. It's heartbreaking, really, to see that we're just going sort of full steam ahead. Have you seen much that gives you faith in humanity in terms of the environment?
You know, for a few years I was very negative and I was very pessimistic about it. But I'm hoping that a new generation, starting from like now,
yeah,
they probably are gonna be the change that we wanna see in the world, because you know, we plant no trees, however we demand that the air is cooler in places like Latin America. We all have ACs. It's like here with central heating, over there is AC. You know.
Yeah.
You have all these companies and corporations that just pollute and destroy the environment, and they have no social responsibility whatsoever. So that's why I think that we're all in this, and and it's an important issue that everyone takes for granted, you know. Everybody
has fresh water. People just turn a blind eye. I think, you know, if you look at intensive farming and things like that, people just out of sight, out of mind. If they can't see it, then it's not affecting them. And I think people really need educating because they're just running aimlessly into a blind future.
Yeah, it's like we're all running towards the cliff, but we're just going to figure out what we're going to do when we reach the end of the cliff.
Yeah.
You know, and it'll be too late because by the time we get there, we're going to be burning our own bridges. So we'll just have to jump off the bridge and that'll be the end of us unless we do something radically.
I'll ask this question to both of you because obviously, you know, you're both from different countries. But in your native countries, do you see much thought for the environment in terms of, we need to change our ways, or is it just head down and plow on?
Well, from my own experience, before the conquistadors came to America and Latin America, we were Indians. We believed in the Pachamama. So it was like Avatar. Before we kill an animal, obviously we were horrible people. We were sacrificing and everything. But before we kill an animal for our own good to eat it, we'll give an offer to the Pachamama, to Mother Earth. But then when the conquistadors came over, we were like in a limbo because they brought their own cultures, they brought religion. And then we didn't know, we lost our identity. And to be fair and honest with you, right now, everyone pollutes. We need more education, a lot more than just two freaking propaganda on TV that says, hey, don't throw rubbish on the street and blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. But we need it on a major scale. We need to make environmental issues part of our daily lives.
Yeah.
We're like far-fetched from Japan and places like Sweden where they recycle everything. That doesn't happen. That's just to be brutally honest with you.
Yeah.
We're miles away from that. Even though everything is green, it's because we have Latin America is just green by nature and we have a lot less people than here, but it's still polluted as hell, you know? Yeah. If you go to places like Indonesia, a friend of mine surfed this place where you're getting a barrel and the whole barrel is covering plastic and
awful.
Same as in the Philippines, same as in India, same as in China. And it's a shame, really. I wish governments could take a different economic model, because capitalism, imperialism, communism, socialism, none of that works, because it's not against our, it's against our nature. We're beings. We're human beings. We're animals. We have more consciousness, but we just like every other animal, and it's just crazy. You know, you go to a supermarket, and when I go there, I just wonder what's gonna happen to all these bottles. What's gonna happen to all these papers? And apparently, 3 out of 5 things that passes your hands will end up in the ocean, and that's just sad.
Yeah,
that's just crazy.
What about you, Dimitri?
I think it's going to be interesting. I am Kazakhstan this last year, I think. It snowed black soot because the air is so polluted in some areas of Kazakhstan where there's a lot of smelting plants and aluminium processing plants. But they don't see the point in investing in the future because they want results today. So I think, unfortunately for humans, anything will only be done when it's too late. And they'll try to use technology to save themselves from any impending doom. So like, I remember a couple of years ago, bees were dying, and this was huge news, and it is huge news, but suddenly someone said, oh, we can just make robotic bees.
Yeah.
It's not an issue. And I was like, oh, okay, fine, yeah, sure. You know, if you look at Flint in Michigan, their water supply is tainted with lead. Still tainted with lead.
Yeah. In a developed country.
Exactly, in the first world country. The richest country in the world has some of the worst water, drinking water in the world. If you look at Russia, I read that global warming is so bad that polar bears have started going inland.
Yeah.
Instead of staying on icebergs.
Yeah, there's that. I don't know.
Yeah, that's kind of crazy because I went to Iceland this year. And, you know, before you only see one polar bear a year. But now one polar bear every 10 years. They will get on these icebergs and it will come all the way from Greenland, and that's a freaking long way to go to Iceland.
Yeah.
But Iceland has this rule and this policy, which is no bears allowed. So every time they get a bear, they will shoot it. There are only 22,000 polar bears in the whole planet left. And you know what? Iceland, it has means, it has money. Because polar bears are aggressive as hell, you know. If they see a human, they'll eat it.
Yeah,
but that's because we destroy their environment. But in saying so they won't ship them over to Greenland because they have a no bear policy. And yeah, sorry to interrupt you. That's just one of things.
No,
it's all good. I mean, I was just gonna say a similar thing. I saw it actually on the news today that there's a town in Russia, sort of isolated islands where there's a township, and 52 bears have invaded it, and there's now a state of emergency. And I was watching a video of some people recording a bear between two blocks of flats looking at the bins, and a guy just goes walking past completely oblivious that there's a bear there. And these bears are, you know, they're going into apartment buildings and offices, and you know, it's obviously completely unnatural, but they're being driven down there because the polar caps are shrinking. And it's just going to bring more and more contact between an apex predator and an animal that can think really well, but can't really defend themselves against a polar bear. And it's only going to spell one thing, really. They're going to get shot. And, you know, We're responsible for this. We're not only are we driving temperatures up, but then we're going to shoot the bears as well because they're impacting on people's lives. So
yeah,
wildlife just can't win, one way or the other.
Yeah,
it's really strange how we as humans hold this moral high ground and yet destroy nature around us. You know, when you hear about how farming destroys about so much land that it's comparable to the size of Wales, I think, a year or something. Mm. Something like that, that it destroys so much forest. Just to make sure that people have enough bread to eat or pasta to have or whatever, or cows, or, you know, it's kind of... It makes you think that the more people there are in the world and the better we become at curing disease, the worse this issue will get because there'll be more mouths to feed.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course, man. We need... I've worked in politics in the past, you know. I was a documentary director for the Calderon government for 5 years, and I worked with a lot of people who were erudites in these kind of subjects, and they, for them, the unless we do something radical, you know, unless we have birth control, like even in places that the ratio is negative, we're gonna have a really dark future, because everything is linked, everything is just, it's like a butterfly effect. Mm-hmm. And we need to be able to, if we want to survive as species, we need to be able to think as one. But it's kind of hard when only 2% of the world capital is allocated or
or a few families own this, or a few corporations have all the wealth and they make all the decisions, you know. It's just unparalleled right now. It's just crazy what we're living in, these kind of things. And if governments don't take proactive measures, we're gonna end up killing ourselves, and that's just inevitable.
I think it's telling how much we want to ignore this issue as a human race, when the richest country in the world, who's probably one of the main polluters in the world, backs out of a Paris Agreement. Mm. The one that's regarding the climate deal and keeping producing only a certain, it's an agreement to produce a certain amount of carbon as a country,
yeah,
and to replenish certain amounts of trees and lower or try and keep the rise of temperatures as low as possible. And when one of the richest countries in the world doesn't want to do it, you know, it's kind of, it says a lot.
Yeah, it really does. It's bad. But I still have faith. I still think that, you know, I look around and there's that young kid, he developed a system for getting plastic out of the oceans, which I think is set sail now. There's companies like 4Ocean, where you can basically buy a bracelet, and it's made 100% of recycled trash pulled out of beach cleans and whatnot. And each bracelet represents 1 pound of trash coming out of the ocean. And, you know, stuff like that is really good. And I think there's a lot of forward-thinking people out there that probably aren't getting the coverage that they deserve. But, you know, I have faith. I think we'll smell the bacon before it's burnt.
Well, I hope so, man.
Yeah,
I really
too.
Hope so.
Me too.
Yeah, definitely. But, well, what can you say? I just hope we get there.
So Raul, how can our listeners reach you?
Well, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram at Raul Nomada, one word. Romeo Alpha Uniform London, Nancy Oscar, Mother Oscar, Delta Alpha. Raul Nomada. Yeah. Nomad A.
I would absolutely recommend following this man. Has a great Instagram channel. It's always interesting to see what he's up to. And you're an unusual man, so it's always good to, you know, to live vicariously. If you're not going to travel, just watch this man's Instagram and Facebook, because you're an intriguing man, and we've loved having you on, mate. We'd love to have you on again, you know, when you've been to a few more places and you have more stories to tell, because we could talk all night, but there's not enough hours in the day. But no, it's been great to have you on. Thank you very much.
Thank you, man. Thanks for having me. And it's awesome that you know me before I had 100 countries on my passport.
Yeah.
Now, soon I'm going to have 100, so it's going to be a little different, you know.
Well, we'll have you on. We'll have you on for the centenary.
Thank you, man. The centenary will be awesome. And thanks for listening to me. Thank you, guys.
That's all good.
And I appreciate it. And don't forget to live life with passion. It sounds crazy, sounds easy, but it is true, man. Life is too short. We're here for a short period of time, and there is nothing better than living life.
Absolutely. No wiser a word said. Well,
yeah, that's an excellent message.
Absolutely. And obviously you can follow us as well on Twitter and Instagram. No, not Instagram, that's a lie, but Facebook. Find us, and hope you've enjoyed this podcast. And yeah, cheers, guys.
Thank you, guys.
Cheers.
Thank you so much. And peace out.
Bye.
Hasta la vista, baby.
Hasta luego.
Hasta luego, amigo. Gracias.